This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, New Jersey reporter Scott Gurian has been covering Hurricane Sandy recovery efforts since the storm hit in late 2012. Nearly a year and a half later, those efforts have become the subject of yet another scandal for the Christie administration. He'll join us for an update on the New Jersey governor's involvement in the spending of Sandy relief funds. We'll also hear later from Second Thoughts Connecticut member Kathy Ludlam for a follow-up conversation on proposed aid in dying legislation. But first, we're going to follow up on another recent episode of Where We Live, which took a look at DCF's proposal to open a second locked facility in Connecticut for girls. Critics call the plan another maximum security facility. Supporters say it's not that at all. But it's a proposal that has many wondering if a second facility like this is really the best way to address the overpopulation issue. Today, we're joined by Commissioner Joette Katz and Superintendent of the School, William Rosenbeck, to discuss what lies ahead for the new facility, which is scheduled to open in Middletown on March 19th. Joette Katz, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
And to William Rosenbeck, thank you for coming in.
Thank you also.
First, I'd like you to listen to a little bit of our show that we aired a few weeks ago. We had on Martha Stone, Executive Director of the Center for Children's Advocacy. Here she is speaking on Where We Live.
They already have this facility. It's called Journey House. It's got 14 beds. It's locked. It's isolated on the grounds of Natchog Hospital. The problem is that there is a gridlock situation. There's a problem at the back end. There's a problem at the front end. The back end problem is girls at Journey House can't get out because there aren't any appropriate community-based services or step-down facilities for them to get out. So as a result, they stay there for as long as 10 months. Research shows us that any girls that stay in a locked, secure facility longer than 3 to 5 months, it's a case of diminishing returns. That's the back end problem. The front end problem is that there's not a continuum of services for juvenile justice girls to prevent them from getting deeper into the system, and the trajectory is that they go from probation to residential to then this locked facility because of the dearth of community-based wraparound services.
And again, that's the voice of Martha Stone. She's executive director of the Center for Children's Advocacy. She was speaking on Where We Live a few weeks ago. Commissioner Katz, maybe you could respond a bit to the concerns that Martha Stone lays out there. That's the problem as she sees it, as we look at this new facility being built in Middletown.
Absolutely. So to her point about that there's not enough going on at the front end, well, in fact, in 2013, there were more than 2,500 girls referred to juvenile court for delinquency proceedings. We're talking about 10. By my math, that means we've been 98% successful with regard to most of those other girls. Obviously, it's not just about the numbers. It's what are we doing for them? Do we need more community-based services? I need that, and I've testified to that ad nauseum, frankly, on all of my programs, mental health, juvenile justice. But that's not the problem here. This is an issue around a very, very small, discrete population. I do agree with her that, by and large, short-term treatment is what is appropriate. And that's why the facility that we're talking about here is it's a 10-bed facility, 2 respite beds. And the average length of treatment is going to be anywhere from 30 days to 6 months. With me, and I don't want to steal your thunder, but with me is William Rosenbeck, who is the superintendent of CJTS and who will be overseeing this unit and who can talk in detail about the kinds of programs that are going to be made available to this small cohort.
But before we get to that, maybe you can just describe for us, as you say, this small cohort. What is it about these 10 girls that need this particular type of facility?
Okay. So many of the girls that we see are victims of trauma. And more often than not, as I've said, we've been able to address their needs, their treatment needs. These girls, some of them are extremely assaultive. I listened to the show when it was live, actually, and I heard about breach of peace, et cetera. I'm not talking about girls who have only committed breach of peace. I want to be clear. We've got one girl now that we're dealing with who was so assaultive that she broke the jaw of one of the women who was supposed to be overseeing her, as well as nearly blinded her. I've got another one who is pregnant, who doesn't take her medications. She runs and she tries to commit suicide fairly routinely. We've got another one who, actually going back to the first girl as an example, when these girls run, and that's part of the problem, they put themselves at risk and they also often take other kids with them and then put them other children for whom we are also responsible at risk. So that's what's unique about these kids. They have been the victims of trauma. They have been either abused, sexually abused, whatever the circumstances are, and they need that much more of an intensive-based treatment.
And one of the things that we heard over and over again during the segment that we did on the program with Martha Stone and others is that it's that very trauma in their background that the advocates are wanting to consider when we look at how exactly we're going to treat them, that indeed putting them in a locked facility of this type is further traumatizing.
Well, sometimes you need to stabilize somebody and you need to be able to contain them for purposes of treatment, because if they run away and they continue to assault other staff as well as put other girls at risk, then we're not going to be able to treat them. And so it's really strictly for that purpose and that purpose only. This is not a detention facility. And in fact, what made me really conclude that this was the right time to do this is I looked at the numbers and I've looked and this has been an ongoing issue in the state of Connecticut since Long Lane School was closed. And there was a discussion about a facility being built in Bridgeport, as you remember, 30 beds, 24 beds. Back then, even the advocates acknowledged the need for a 10-bed facility. I heard them, and I have since heard them. People may not want to talk about this publicly because it's not, it's not generally their what they want to be known for. But I think if you really talk to people offline, so to speak, they acknowledge that there's a small cohort. So when I looked at the numbers, and then I looked at the girls in detention, and on any given time we have upwards of 20 girls in detention, they're not getting treatment there. That's not what the detention facility is supposed to be. Then I looked at the numbers of the girls sent to York. And I just want to state by way of explanation, you know my background. I was a litigator. I was a trial judge. And then I was a Superior Court Justice. What I think goes on when girls are sent to York, and young girls, and there are currently 7 girls there now who are 17, 18. And what happens is when they get transferred to what we call high court, judges have an opportunity to decide whether or not the child should go back to juvenile. And one of the things the court's going to look at in deciding whether or not a child should go back to juvenile court is to say, okay, well, what would the juvenile courts do for this child? What treatment facilities are available? What options are available? And if a judge sees that the child cannot get treatment because she has engaged in very serious behavior, otherwise she wouldn't have been transferred to adult court to begin with, so she's already engaged in really serious behavior, very serious risk behavior to herself as well as to others, the court looks to see what's available. When there's nothing available, the child goes to York. Now, is that a better solution? I would say obviously not. And so that was another part of the consideration in deciding that this was the time to really finally take this on.
We're talking today with Joette Katz, who's the commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Children and Families, following up on a conversation we had about a new facility that's proposed for Middletown, scheduled to open very soon, as a matter of fact, a 10-bed facility for girls. Also with us is William Rosenbeck, who's superintendent of that facility. We hear different terms for these facilities, words like school, words like prison, treatment facility. Could you describe what the current facility for girls is exactly and what you provide there and what this new facility will provide?
Well, the new facility is really a secure treatment model. And the emphasis really is on treatment. When you talk about security and maximum security, you take away from really what's happening within the program. And that's the most important piece to achieve. And really a big emphasis of the departments is to provide national best practices, evidence-based interventions, such as Girl Circle, DBT, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, our 7 challenges, our aggressive replacement training. So we really are taking the best interventions throughout the country that are often used also in other programs within Connecticut and implementing them into the milieu of the program. So, yeah, the doors are locked, but the primary focus of this facility is treatment, rapid reintegration. So the girls come in, we stabilize, we provide the appropriate interventions, and then move them out very quickly back to where they came from, back to the community in a very short amount of time.
Could you talk about what is provided for them back in the community? If the commissioner is talking about girls who are not just in here for, in part, breach of peace, but they're young women who have been violent toward others, talk about the process of very quickly getting them treated and then back in the community in a place in which they will thrive, but then also not be a danger to anyone else.
Sure. And I think one of the nice parts about the interventions we have, the other providers have, is that they're also offered in the community. So you can quickly get the girl back focused on the treatment issues she needs to deal with, get her stabilized, and continue that back out in the community. So there's a whole menu of services each of the regions have for the girls and the boys, particularly MST Fit, MST RAFT, many of those multi-systemic treatment models that are used in the community and within the home to help link the treatment that the girl received in care back out in the community in a different form so that it's a continuation of those treatments. And that has really proven to be very successful.
If you have thoughts on this issue, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can always tweet us at Where We Live. You can email Where We Live. Commissioner Katz, the current facility that we have right now, is it indeed overpopulated? Just talk a bit more about the need for this new facility.
Well, so there's a wait list on one of the facilities, the only other locked facility that's Journey House, and it, there's a three girls waiting to get in. So, you know, the advocates keep harping on that and saying, look, those girls aren't there, they're there too long, et cetera. Well, just to be clear, Value Options, which is our ASO, reviews those girls every month. So it's not like they're just deposited there. In fact, not only does the ASO review them, but Tammy Sneed, who's in charge of our girls' services, is there regularly. Dr. Linda Dixon of DCF is there regularly, engaging with Journey House, engaging with the staff, talking about all the various therapies and treatment models, et cetera, so that these girls are not just deposited. And I really want to correct that that assessment. So, yeah, there are three girls on a wait list, and there are girls in detention, and then there are girls in York, and then there are girls currently that we're aware of that really very easily can fill these 10 beds.
When we talk about building a facility like this that I assume is going to cost some amount of money over and above just the building of another building. I mean, this will cost multi-millions of dollars to operate and run. And we're talking about doing this for just 10 girls or an overflow of three girls, and this is why we're building it. I'm wondering if you can just talk through the dollars and sense of this, Commissioner, because I think a lot of people say, well, you're 98% successful. Most of the girls aren't in a facility like this. Why do we have to spend so much money and go through all of this angst in order to provide this exact facility for such a small number of girls?
Thank you for that opportunity. First of all, this is a building that needed minor renovations. It had previously been used on our psychiatric hospital. So unlike the conversations that took place years ago about spending tens of millions of dollars, this was a $500,000 renovation. We have obviously had to hire some additional staff, but it's not as if these girls weren't consuming dollars anyway. They were consuming law enforcement dollars. They were consuming detention dollars, judicial branch. They're consuming York dollars. And some of them historically have been sent out of state at a much higher cost. So it's not, to be fair, let's do apples to apples. It's actually in the long run going to be more cost effective to treat them here in our own facility, on our own premises, than any of the other alternatives where they currently are situated.
William, do you have a sense of the cost year over year of having one of these girls in a facility like this or a similar facility versus being in a community setting? It's one of the things that when we were talking with advocates before, they stressed that it's much less expensive to have girls in less restrictive settings.
That is true, but you have to get them there first. And I think that's, as Commissioner Katz says, we're spending a lot of dollars and resources trying to just find the girl, maintain the girl, and they consistently run away and continue the behavior that needs to be stopped initially. So by bringing the girls into secure care for a very short amount of time, you're stopping that. You're sort of refocusing the girl, reinventing the treatment plan and making the treatment more effective for the girl back in the community. So it really is a short stay to stop all those actions and then get her back out there where they're right. It is cheaper out in the community than it is in care.
I want to get to a few phone calls quickly. Sean's in Milford. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to offer a perspective. I'm an attorney, and I represent the family of a police officer in Westchester County who was paralyzed after a juvenile in an unlocked facility who had escaped four times previously from that facility. He was 15 years old, stole a car, and led police on a high-speed chase that resulted in a terrible crash and injuries to this police officer. And so my perspective is just, I think there has to be a place where, you know, certain children can be in a secure environment to protect themselves and others.
Sean, thank you very much. Just very quickly, you said that this particular individual was a young man or a young girl?
This was a young man.
Thank you very much for that. Joey Katz, how much of a difference should we draw between young men in these situations and young women? And quickly, let's speak about that. We've heard some of the numbers about girls in these facilities. What are the realities for boys in these facilities or similar facilities here in Connecticut?
Well, we have CJTS. And that's really the inequity thus far. We've always treated boys, and I'm terribly sorry for Sean's clients and his family's loss, no doubt. And that's exactly the situation I can't attest to, where that child was, who that child was. It happened in Westchester, where it was my child, or New York facility, New York child. But we've always attended to the needs of the boys. We have not historically attended to the needs of the girls, and I'm trying to write that.
How many boys are in a similar facility in CJTS?
About 140.
And that's out of a population of how many? So we're talking about 2,500 girls in the system and a handful, really, a couple dozen girls that we have to treat in this way. We have 140 boys in this facility. How many young men are in the system?
I say at least about 10,000 referrals each year to juvenile court, which results in about 200 to 300 boys committed each year to the Department of Children and Families. So the same percentage of about 2% of the kids, 3% of the boys are in need of DCF care.
My goodness. Let's go quickly to Yolanda, who's calling from Hartford. Hi, Yolanda. Go ahead.
We have 100.
Hello.
Hi, Yolanda. If you can turn down your radio in the background, then we can talk. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Hi. Yes. What I was saying was not just from, you know, book sense. I'm saying from actual experience. You have people that live in the community. You have parents that have dealt with this. You have some parents that were that before they changed their lives. And I'm saying, how many of those have they incorporated in this so-called institution, I should say, to help these kids? I mean, you know, the best drug counselor is a drug addict. You understand me? I mean, how many people do they have in this to incorporate what their thoughts and their feelings and stuff were that have overcome the situation that these young girls and guys are going through now? And when you look back at it, we had a place called Long Lane back then when I was coming up. How are they helping the parents in the home situation? You know what I mean? Because when you look at it, it's all really coming from the home.
Yolanda, well, first, thank you very much for your phone call, and you raised some good issues. I think she's talking, Joette Katz, about what we do to reach out to parents in the home, but she's also asking about the mix of people who are working with these young girls and boys. Can you answer a bit of what Yolanda asks?
Actually, I'd love Bill to answer that because he's hired the staff.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we have some very highly trained and skilled staff, but we're also really helping them focus on how to engage families from the start. So family work is everybody's work. It's not just a clinical work. So one of the new approaches we're taking is how to engage families from the start. Families are an important part. They know the kids better than we do. So we are establishing a process where twice a week we're going to have a teaming occur where every significant person in a girl's life comes to the program, sits down, discusses a case, and figures out a different way or a new approach to work with her. We're also, to go along with that point, engaging with Women on Our Own. That's a program out at York for women inmates who are transitioning back to the community. They have a singing group, and they'll be coming to our facility from York to sort of do a little show for the girls and talk to the girls about sort of their situations and what cause them to ultimately get to York and using some of their actual experiences to talk to our girls about. And some of the girls, women at York, talked about when they went running away, they really were running from themselves and they needed the help that they didn't get. And that's what we're hoping to provide.
We just have one quick call. Colleen's on asking, I think, about runaways. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yeah, so I have a numbers question. As far as I understand, only 4 girls went AWOL from juvenile justice programs last year. And of all the girls who had to be sent out of state because we supposedly didn't have the right programming, only one of them went to a locked facility. So I don't get where you get the need from 12 beds out of that.
Well, as I said, I'm looking at the girls in detention and who are languishing in detention, and that's not to disparage my former colleagues, but that the role of a detention facility is very limited and it doesn't offer the treatment options. I'm looking at the girls at York, and I also approve every out-of-state case. Currently, we have 28 kids out of state, down from 364. And I highlight that because I just want to emphasize, I think I'm getting this reputation that all I want to do is lock people up, when in fact, I think in the last 3 years, we have done more to get children back to their homes, back to their communities, and back in state than any prior administration. And my staff has worked extremely hard doing that. I review all the out-of-state placements, and I can tell you that many of these girls, some of them and boys, have gone into locked facilities over the last 3 years, and some of them are in situations where even if not locked, they're on one-on-one, two-on-one, and I don't know that that's any better or any more realistic or representative for them in terms of their long-term success either, frankly.
When you also look at the girls currently in our caseload and we assess their situations, 60 girls had gone AWOL just last year while within DCF care, either in congregate care or back in the community. So those are also numbers that we looked at.
60 girls in total of the entire population that you're dealing with?
Correct. That went AWOL throughout the course of last year.
And I want to be clear what we mean by AWOL. I mean, I'm not talking about a kid who walks across the street and is smoking a cigarette behind a package store provider can see the child. I'm talking about children, or Bill's talking about children, who when they go AWOL continue to engage in very risky behavior, dangerous to themselves and often to others.
Joette Katz is Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Children and Families. Thank you so much for joining us again today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having us.
And William Rosenbeck is superintendent of the school. And thank you very much, William, for being here as well.
Thank you.
We can always continue this conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. Coming up next, New Jersey reporter Scott Gurian gives us the latest on Governor Chris Christie's latest scandal involving the spending of Hurricane Sandy relief funds. You kind of won't believe what he's uncovering. 860-275-7266 if you want to join us where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie continues to make his way through a stream of scandals, many involving political retribution against his opponents, most notably, of course, the George Washington Bridge closure scandal. But one of the stories to emerge has revolved around the allocation of Superstorm Sandy relief funds. One of the local officials questioning Governor Christie's use of relief money is Hoboken Mayor Don Zimmer. She refused to endorse Christie, and subsequently she got less than 1% of the Sandy relief money she requested. Here's Zimmer speaking to WNYC back in January.
With anything with 2020 hindsight, I mean, in the context that we're in right now, you can always look back and say, like, okay, you know, it was a retribution, but, like, you know, so I think probably all mayors are reflecting right now and thinking about it. But, you know, I really hope that that's not the case.
Joining us now to talk about his investigation into the allocation of Sandy funds is Scott Gurian. He's Sandy recovery reporter for New Jersey Spotlight and WNYC. He joins us from a studio at Montclair State University. Scott, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
So maybe you can lay out a little bit about first what you found about the way Hoboken was getting Superstorm Sandy money.
Okay. And first of all, the one thing I should make clear is administration officials would be quick to point out that they would call this aid money or mitigation money, not relief money. The specific fund that I've looked at is through FEMA's Hazard Mitigation Grant Program, a $25 million pot of money called the Energy Allocation Initiative. And this isn't for direct recovery, you know, repair of storm damage. This is rather for mitigation resiliency measures for future storms. So this money was specifically for backup generators and other energy resilience sorts of measures. New Jersey got $25 million of this money after any major disaster that the president declares. Every state gets hazard mitigation money. Connecticut did as well after Sandy. The state put aside this $25 million of this money for municipalities around the state to apply. There were a number of factors that the state judged these and ranked these applications on, including the population of the applicant, the density, how much they had requested in past FEMA disaster assistance, and whether or not they'd had an energy audit. Hoboken, along with a number of other municipalities, applied for some of this money. Hoboken submitted requests for 12 different generators, totaling $1.7 million. In the end, they received just $142,000 through this program. We actually were able to do the score ourselves, we obtained a leaked copy of the internal score sheet state officials used. And according to our analysis, we found that instead of 142,000, Hoboken should, if the scoring had been done properly and according to the state's own criteria, should have received about 840,000, 7,000 more than state officials had given Hoboken.
So Hoboken should have gotten a lot more money. They, according to your reporting, got about the same money as some smaller towns, including some towns that that really didn't have much damage at all from Sandy. So let's circle back, though, to some of the potential reasons for all this. We heard a little bit from the mayor of Hoboken. What do we know about why this happened, why Hoboken may have been singled out, or maybe some other communities may have been singled out by the Christie administration?
Well, and that's a hard question to answer. Obviously, that's the question everyone wants to know. Why did this happen? Were there politics involved in this aid selection process? Were politics not involved? And it's difficult to answer at this point because it's not, from my standpoint, from my investigation, it's not a clear-cut picture. It's not totally black and white. I've tried to look at kind of different trends with mayors who supported the governor in his bid for re-election or, you know, various other factors. And it's difficult to do that analysis, especially here in New Jersey, because there are a lot of kind of weird political alliances where staunch Democrats who you'd think would be opposed to the governor would have actually formed these kind of odd political alliances. So it's difficult to say at this point. I'm really not sure what the reasons were. It's hard also because there's some real basic questions about what went on behind the scenes that I have yet to get answers on from administration officials. For example, this working group that state officials formed to do this ranking and scoring, we know that it was representatives of four different agencies who were on this working group, but we've asked questions like, who specifically was on this working group? How many members from each agency? How many times did they meet? Were these agency staffers or political appointees, you know, real basic things like that we have yet to get answers on. And until we do, it's hard to kind of get a better sense of what the motivations or reasons might have been.
We're talking with Scott Gurian, who's Sandy recovery reporter for New Jersey Spotlight and for WNYC. He joins us from a studio today at Montclair State University, and we're talking about the latest scandal surrounding the Chris Christie administration, in part due to a series of reports that Scott's been doing for WNYC and NJ Spotlight. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Now, you asked a former state employee to look over the scoring data you've been speaking of. Mark Moriello worked for the Department of Environmental Protection for 3 decades. Here's what he said about the scoring process.
It just seems to me that this thing by nature creates a lot of opportunity to really make funding decisions that might not be in the best interest of the state when you look at it as a whole, one community over another.
So it seems as though other people, Scott, share your suspicion about whether or not this system works as well as it could. Give us a little bit more details about this. It seems as though this is probably something that people weren't taking a very close look at until just about now.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is a complicated story. It's a number story, and I have a little bit of a challenge every time I even try to explain it to people because their eyes kind of gloss over. It was very complicated, even to this gentleman I spoke to, Mark Moriello, former head of the Department of Environmental Protection. I shared with him the documents we had received and the analysis I had conducted. And he himself, you know, even with all his prior experience, looked at the copy of his score sheet and said, well, this is really complex. They chose so many different categories, you know, 7 or 8 different categories that they scored each of these applications on. And he felt in some ways it may have been unnecessarily complex. And when you have all these different categories, all these different places you could, you know, put points for to add up to the total number of points, from his standpoint, just created the opportunity. If someone wanted to tamper with the numbers, they could easily, you know, add a few points here, subtract a few points there to change the total. And each application had to receive at least 80 points in order to receive any funding at all. So in many cases, it received just less than that or just of that, and that little difference could make the difference between whether an applicant, a municipality, got hundreds of thousands of dollars more or less than it otherwise should have.
Now, as a result of your reporting, there's been a response from state officials who aren't necessarily saying that this is all political, but they're saying maybe it's just sort of an incompetent system. What are you hearing from other state officials?
Yeah, we've tried to get out of them to ask them, I mean, do you have any response to our specific analysis, the specific numbers we've come up with, you know, saying, for example, that Hoboken should have gotten $700,000 more than it was awarded. They have not, you know, given any specific responses or pointed out anywhere where they feel our numbers were wrong. Their overall, you know, response has been that they say the process is still preliminary, that it's unfair to, you know, that we're basically jumping the gun. To be clear, none of this money has actually been handed out yet. But these allocation amounts were announced to municipalities. It's been like 5 months since October. All these towns and cities received letters saying, yes, you've been approved for this program, the ones that were approved, and this is the specific amount we're planning on giving you. The state, as well as many local officials, sent out press releases at that time announcing their specific award decisions. There were some revisions that were made between October and December. But then, you know, since that time, all these towns have been asked to submit detailed spending plans, how they intend to spend these specific amounts they've been given. They've obviously prepared in their budgets at this point. And the state themselves, you know, were the ones who released this list back in October, and then the revised list in January, saying how much all these towns were going to get. So to now say that kind of jumping the gun, that, I mean, we're using the state's own information that they released. And they put this out there after Hoboken Mayor Dawn Zimmer came out and claimed that she felt her city was shortchanged in Sandiade. This information was presented by the state as a response to say, look, here's the amounts all these other cities are getting. What Hoboken got was roughly on par with these other cities. Now that we're using that in a way that isn't, you know, I guess from the state's political advantage, they're saying that we've jumped the gun and that we shouldn't be using this information. It seems like a double standard.
A last thing for you, Scott. I think that this is an important part of the reporting that you're doing here. When we heard about this bridge scandal in the Christie administration, a lot of the focus has been around the politics, about what this might mean for Chris Christie moving forward in a presidential bid, what it means about insider New Jersey politics, what it meant for the people who were stuck on that day trying to get across the bridge. But when you're talking about the allocation of relief funds meant to help in the future, meant to mitigate future disasters, meant to help towns recover from Sandy relief or from a storm like Sandy in relief efforts, it seems as though this might really go to the heart of how well New Jersey has responded to this terrible disaster. Do you think in any of the reporting that you've done that some of these funding problems may have compromised towns and cities in New Jersey from being able to be as resilient as they should be when we move forward into another storm season coming up?
It's hard to say at this point. One community I found that had been shortchanged, Belmar, which is down the Jersey Shore. I spoke to the mayor yesterday. In their situation, they actually got lucky and went to the U.S. Army. They had a surplus stockpile they found out in Pennsylvania and were able to get some generators and other equipment in that instance. So they're okay. Other places, in Hoboken's case, they're passing a bond issue. So that in the end, I guess taxpayers are going to have to pay for this, so they will be able to come up with the money. I've just surveyed a few communities here and there, so I don't know kind of the big picture. State officials say they are coming out with another program in the next coming months, another energy resilience program, a $210 million energy bank, because they saw how much demand there was for these generators.
Scott Gurian is a Sandy recovery reporter for NJ Spotlight and for WNYC. If you want to read more about his investigation, you can go to njspotlight.com, and you can also listen on wnyc.org. Thanks as always, Scott. Coming up next, we're going to revisit another story that we talked about here on Connecticut and bring in a member of Second Thoughts Connecticut. They're a disability rights group opposed to the legalization of assisted suicide in our state. If you want to join that conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email wherelive at wnpr.org or go on Twitter and tweet us at wherelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, after Sandy Hook, many schools started employing armed guards in urban districts. The school resource officer has long been a fixture in urban areas. So how effective is an armed presence? Do armed guards make for safer learning environments? And how much are these guards costing school districts? You can join us on the next Where We Live. Today in the program, we are looking back at a conversation that we held just a few weeks ago about aid in dying legislation that's now in front of lawmakers at the state capitol. We were reading the Hartford Courant and looking at a Quinnipiac University poll the other day, which at the very top of the front page on Friday, they put a story that says aid in dying favored. And they had some of the views that people had on this. The question, do you support allowing doctors to help terminally ill patients end their lives? 61% of those polled say yes, 32% in opposition. But joining us now is Kathy Ludlum, member of Second Thoughts Connecticut, a disability rights group opposed to the legalization of assisted suicide. And we heard from a number of people in that community. And Kathy, I want to first of all welcome you to the program. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what are your thoughts on this push for aid in dying legislation? Why are you opposed to it?
Well, there are so many reasons that we could be here for a couple of hours, but I know we don't have that long. I think a couple of the main ones are to put to rest this idea that it's about pain and suffering at the end of life. You will hear proponents say over and over, this is so that people will not be suffering. Certainly, we don't want people to suffer. None of us on the opposing side want anyone to suffer. But statistically, that is not why it's used. If you look at data from Oregon, mainly it's used by people because they fear losing autonomy or they're concerned about being less able to engage in things they had previously done that they enjoyed or losing dignity. And in the list of issues, inadequate pain control or fear of inadequate pain control fall number 6 out of 7 concerns on this form that doctors have to fill out when a patient comes to them and says, I want to use this.
Mm. One of the things that I think is important, we talk about language all the time in our program.
Yes.
Language is very, very important. Advocates for this particular bill, including advocates who've taken time out on our radio station, and I will just say advertising on our radio station, underwriting, if you will, call it death with dignity. What do you think of that term?
I think that's a real problem because that would seem to imply that if you need assistance at the end of your life, and by definition, most people who are terminally ill will be disabled for a period of time, needing assistance with bathing or eating or personal tasks. And that really implies that those needing help with those tasks is undignified. And those of us who use that support every day, and it's a normal part of our lives, we know that there's nothing undignified about that. It's just a euphemism to try and make the practice of assisted suicide look more palatable to people.
And so the term that you would prefer if we're going to discuss this is assisted suicide. That's what it is.
That's what we think it is by definition.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Now, at a press conference at the Legislative Office Building in Hartford, Sarah Meyer, who is an aid in dying activist with ALS, she's confined to a wheelchair, she spoke of the comforts that having end-of-life rights would bring. Let's listen to her. I'm being told we don't have that piece of tape, and I apologize. This is a quote from her. I'm going through a horrible situation. There are other people who go through similar situations, and I've considered moving to Oregon, to Washington, where this is legal. I've considered going to the Netherlands. Ultimately, I don't want to leave my home, and I'd love to see doctors be able to help us at the end of our life. It's a very personal issue to me. Whether I ever used the option, knowing it was there to would allow me to live my day without so much fear about what the future has. I'm wondering if you could respond to what she had to say.
Well, I'm really, I feel a lot of compassion for her, and I'm sorry that she's in so much fear about what's going to happen. And my suggestion would be that rather than fear it, learn about people who have gone through the same process and gone through it without needing to resort to these kind of extreme measures.
But what would be your reason for denying her an opportunity to make that choice at the end of her life? It's clearly a choice that you wouldn't want to make and a choice that you would advise others against making. And I think that you make, Kathy, a very strong, strong argument for that. But what would be your reason for wanting to not allow her to have that choice?
Well, I think the problem is, it's fine that everyone has that choice. Everyone already has that choice. But what we're talking about is codifying and endorsing that choice by making it part of our legal system and part of our medical practice. I think that's what changes it, is it removes it from the arena of a personal choice and makes it a societal movement.
But I guess when you say that everyone does have that choice right now, truly they don't. I mean, it's an illegal act in Connecticut. I as I mentioned on the program that we did some weeks ago, I covered a case some years ago in which a gentleman was prosecuted for helping an elderly friend who wished to end his life, who was suffering greatly, and he was actually prosecuted for helping him die. There are legal ramifications for those who would aid or for the individuals themselves. And so, indeed, it's not actually a choice that people have right now, is it?
It is a choice that people have. It really is. Because, for one thing, people already have the choice of palliative care. They can, if they're suffering that greatly, they can even choose terminal sedation, in which they are sedated to a point of unconsciousness and would not feel pain anymore. And I'm not saying that that's an answer to everything, but I'm saying it's unnecessary because we have choices like that available now. We also have choices in terms of advanced directives and other things about how far people might want to go with treatment. And I do want to mention another piece of legislation that will be up this coming week on Friday, that is regarding medical orders for life-sustaining treatment, which would expand people's choices in terms of what they, how long they want to live, and how many interventions they want to have.
And that has to do with interventions and directives. It doesn't have to do specifically with wanting to terminate one's life.
It does not. But what, if we're talking about choices, why not talk about all choices? This is one choice, but there are many choices.
We're talking with Kathy Ludlam, who's a member of Second Thoughts Connecticut, a disability rights group opposed to the legalization of assisted suicide, the Aid in Dying legislation that is currently at the state capitol that we spoke about a few weeks ago. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I read the results of this Quinnipiac poll off the top of our segment. I'm wondering what your response is to 61% of Connecticut residents saying that they support some sort of legislation like this.
Well, I want to make sure everyone knows the exact language of what people were answering, because, of course, how a poll turns out is based on the questions asked. The question asked was, do you support or oppose allowing doctors to legally prescribe lethal drugs to help terminally ill patients end their own lives? So that is... does not mention at all assisted suicide, yet not that newspaper that you just read, but a lot of headlines have said the public supports assisted suicide. That's not what they answered. And in addition, a Gallup poll taken last May of 2013 showed that the percentage points actually changed by about 20%, depending on whether you ask about assisted suicide or aid in dying. So
you're saying the language really does matter?
I'm saying the language really does matter. And the other thing I would need to point out is that a similar proposal in Massachusetts, a poll there showed 68% in favor the day before the vote, and it failed.
I want to go to Judy in Watertown quickly. Hi, Judy. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that my father was dying of pancreatic cancer. Mm. My mother was perfectly healthy. She refused to have him go back to the hospital to have any extraordinary work done. Mm. They ended up committing suicide together. Mm. And that was incredibly traumatic for the whole family.
Mm. Of course. And I'm so sorry for your loss.
Well, that didn't help. I think if there had been a possibility of assisted suicide, she would not have done what she did. And I guess that's all I have to say.
Judy, thank you very much. And again, I echo what Kathy said. I'm very sorry for your loss. We just have a few minutes left, but maybe you could respond. That's the voice of someone who's essentially saying perhaps her mother's life would have been saved mm-hmm. by the ability for a true
assisted suicide or aid in dying law that would have provided different choices for her father.
Right. And I know her pain is unimaginable, and I really thank her for speaking out that way. I think we do have to have a dialogue about things like this. I'm glad that we are having a dialogue about things like this. I think it's important that we do look at lots of options and choices and how to improve things so that people are not brought to that level of desperation. Perhaps if they had had more support, somehow maybe it wouldn't have gone that way. And some on the opposing side have been trying to reduce this issue to six-word slogans. And I just think we need to have full discussions, not sound bites about this.
Quickly, Charles is on the cell phone. Hi, Charles.
Hi, John.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to offer a perspective as a physician in support of Kathy's statements here. And you had mentioned that, you know, that there are the issues of choice and that there wasn't really a choice. The choice, you know, has always been there for people to commit suicide. And that really, as she said, that's how it should be looked at. This is a proposal that is trying to legitimize a course of action that people who are desperate, fearful, or otherwise feel they have no options can choose. But it's in the absence of all of those other things that they should have access to or that we should be providing them as caregivers. And that's not something that we should codify in law, because the option from a choice to a requirement, that might be going a little far, but from a choice to a responsibility to relieve other people's concern about their financial well-being or your suffering or their suffering for you or all those kind of things is not that big a step. And as soon as people get the sense that they don't have to do what they can to help support somebody in their life, then the option of choosing dying becomes, a lot easier.
But do we have, and very quickly, Charles, do we have all those other supports in place? And do we have any ability to get those supports for all the people who need them?
No, that's a lack. But a lack in our systems shouldn't be an excuse to go and put something in place that should not be there.
Charles, thank you very much. A quick last phone call here from Ellen in Stanford. Let's see if I can actually get to Ellen's phone call. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live. Very quickly, Ellen.
Yes. I happen to have cancer. I have had a different cancer previously. This one will be terminal. My mother was in a nursing home for 10 years. She had dementia. She is now dead, thank God. And it took her a month and a half to die, and it was horrific. And I talked to the other caregivers of other patients, and we're all in our 50s, 60s, 70s, and we all feel the same, is that we don't want to go through this, and we don't have choices. I heard what the doctor said, and he's wrong. We don't have the ability to help the person leave this world when they're not interested anymore. And yes, we certainly understand that there are complicating factors, but the young woman that you have on who's arguing for this, we don't have choices. We don't at all.
And Ellen, I apologize, and I wish you the very best. And I apologize because we've just run out of time here in this conversation. But Kathy Ludlam, I want to thank you for helping us have this continued dialogue, and I think we should continue this in the weeks and months ahead. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Kathy Ludlam is a member of Second Thoughts Connecticut, a disability rights group opposed to the legalization of assisted suicide. If you want to listen back to our earlier conversation, you can go to WNPR.org. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Katie Tolarski is the executive producer. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.